nation. Must be African education. We want a revolution. Young people revolution. Intelligent revolution. Must be black people education.
Them go use waiting them know. Them go use. news area boys, yo. Them go use ex-politicians too. Africa, yeah. Name all this bad, 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 bad. Even if he go for jail, not pay him go pay. Enough.
be like this multi way them they are. Everybody they respect big thief. Now police they protect and guard the thief. The same police were supposed to arrest the thief. So you go see them, they show them power to
give money.
You go see them, they show them power to
give money.
Oga for bank, you go sit down, you go there.
Give money.
Oil company, Oga, you go sit down, you go there. For government house them just they
give
with them different type to they go just they
give
go they
yeah.
They go they
only
they go just they
give money
they go they
yeah.
They go they
they
go just they
give
they go they
yeah.
They go they
only
they go just they
give money
yeah. But the truth my people whether he big or he little fifth not if my brother the truth my people whether he big or he little. Less more sense you get, Mr. Big Thief. Less more sense you get, Mr. Big Thief. Less more sense you get when you afford the food. Yeah, when you afford the food, them go they throw a big party. Billionaire party. Government official fee get 50 houses. And the people no get where to stay. Less more sense be that, Mr. Big Thief. Now this sense where they rule us for Africa be that. Now this sense of Mr. Big Thief. They make them they chop, forget to belly fool. Forget batter, like a bushman. Like a bushman. Yeah, like a bushman. Like a bushman. Like a bushman.
You are listening to Dias Folk Music on Uhuru. This is the Uhuru Radio Network. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Southern California. We have been listening to the music of Seyoum Kuti and Egypt 80. And Seyoum Kuti is Fela Kuti's youngest son. He has another son called Femi, and Femi Kuti, and they both are fine musicians. And Seyoum is the youngest and quite good. He did a song called Africa, African Soldiers, Mr. Big Thief. And we also heard from Tekin Dja Fole, African Revolution. And Tekin Dja Fole is from the Côte d'Ivoire, the so-called Ivory Coast. And we will be playing more from him and the Kutis, Fela, Femi, and Seyoum. We are big fans of the Kuti family at Uhuru Radio. And we're going to be speaking with Izili Danto momentarily. Later on, we're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn. And Melville Liston, who is no longer in the land of the living, was born in Kansas City, and she grew up in Los Angeles, California. And she joined the Ancestors, I think in 1999, but she was a woman, a great trombone player and an arranger. She worked closely with Randy Weston. And we're going to listen to Ms. Liston work out with Quincy Jones's band, and she's going to be playing a song called My Reverie. And this is a woman who can handle the trombone. This is our sister, Melba Liston. You are listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. We were listening to the music of Melba Liston, who is no longer in the land of the living. She worked very closely with Randy Weston. She also went to the she taught at the University of the West Indies in Kingston, Jamaica, and she worked with Motown. She worked with Quincy Jones, and she is missed. And joining us on the line from New York City is Ezili Bonifanto, is with the Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network, and she's also an artist. We have seen her in concert in performance in Toronto, Canada. And how are you doing, Ms. Danto?
I'm fine, thank you.
I wanted to talk to you about a number of things. First, we wanted to talk about the earthquake, third anniversary of the earthquake in Haiti. There have been many earthquakes in Haiti, but we want to talk about the one that took place 3 years ago. I also wanted to discuss with you the fact that Al Prentice Bunchy Carter, the head of the Los Angeles Black Panther Party, was a student of Dessalines. Then I wanted to talk about women and the Haitian Revolution. And then we wanted to talk about some of your ideas about moving forward. But I guess the first thing we wanted to discuss is the earthquake, which took place 3 years ago, and the aftermath of the earthquake, what has taken place or what has taken place since the earthquake.
Right. Well, even before the earthquake, we were under occupation. So folks really must understand that. And there were about 10,000 UN troops acting as proxy for the U.S. military occupation of Haiti. And so when the earthquake happened on January 12, 2010, you had all of these troops, UN troops, in Haiti at all of the various hamlets and regions in Haiti. But obviously, the fact of the matter is they are not in Haiti to protect the Haitian people because, you know, you do not see thousands of those folks rushing to Port-au-Prince and lifting up the concrete and the steel off of the heads of the Haitian people. In fact, some of CNN folks caught the UN just, you know, they did sustain about 100, 125 folks in their headquarters who perished. But most of the folks were outside of that, and there was no help for Haiti, really, truly. Essentially, there was a lot of great people from America who saw the horrific pictures, and I think, you know, one out of every two, I mean, it was just a humongous number of human beings and individuals who sympathize and empathize and send money to the non-governmental organizations like Red Cross and so forth. But most of that money, as the New York Times recently just said, did not leave a footprint in Haiti. There are 400,000 Haitians still homeless. A lot of the money is still in the banks of these non-governmental organizations, and that which has been used has not been used in, you know, with the Haitian government. It's not been used with the Haitian people. Each of the charities have used it in the ways that they feel like using it. And there is no footprint in Haiti. And the people really feel like there's been an embezzlement, a misery. Their misery is used to buy foreign products, foreign goods, like, you know, bottled water and so forth. So essentially, I always like to take this time, really, to tell people that U.S. aid is not about helping Haiti. U.S. aid is about providing money to the U.S. corporations to buy U.S. products. That's basically what it's about. 98% of the money stays in Washington, Toronto, and Paris. So let's put that aside and look at the people of Haiti and where we are as a people. $7.5 billion, they say, have been dispersed since the 3 years. And where we are as a people is that the use of this trauma is what folks need to concentrate on. The use of this trauma to further dominate Haiti, to further destroy the population and black development, black culture, black life. That's what it's all about, and that's really what people should concentrate on.
Could I ask you one thing about a couple of countries are involved in this, not just the U.S., but Canada and France. Could you talk about the role that Canada and France are playing? Because it seems like Canada is really getting the pass.
Exactly. It's sort of the triumvirate, the three northern Euro settlers with a significant history in Haiti. And, of course, Canada is lately into it. as it tries to ingratiate itself into, you know, U.S. superpower good graces. And also, mining companies have a nice home in Canada because of its better, you know, environmental, mining companies, whenever they get in trouble in Africa, they'll just, you know, reorganize and go organize somewhere in Canada. So there are many, many mining companies out of Haiti that are in Haiti right now from Canada, but they're really rehashed U.S. corporations. You know, it's a global world with these global repugnant elites coming from everywhere, France, Canada, U.S., to essentially, folks must understand, the U.S. occupation in Haiti is a war of resources. And
resources.
So, but resources, a war of resources, and it's the scam is that this is humanitarian aid, but that is a scam. What it is behind this humanitarian aid, since 2004, they've been carting out our iridium, our coltan, and our gold and oil. So the white saviors, the leftists, the white liberals, they don't open their mouth to talk about that because then they wouldn't have a job. So Haitian Lawyers Leadership Network is the one that have consistently been trying to explain to folks what is going on in Haiti is not different than what is going on in the Congo. So, for instance, they finally said after 9 years of denying it about Haiti's gold. So right now, if you can just Google it, Haiti's gold is, they say, one of the largest cachet in the Western Hemisphere, $20 billion worth of gold, and it's being mined by Canadian companies. And as I said, you know what that means. And they're doing open pit mining. Now, that is the worst sort of mining where they've used lead and arsenic and all sorts of things that leave a horrendous environmental devastation. And they're doing
so
that in time of cholera.
Pardon me. So it's not... It's detrimental to the environment as well as to the workers who work those places are really, they're taking their lives at risk, or their lives are at risk doing their work.
Precisely. And so they have to cover it up by saying Haiti's poor, because they're taking all of Haiti's resources, and then they can cover it up by keeping the people in oppressed, marginalizing them with this humanitarian troops that are on there. Now, what made it worse is that after the earthquake, 7 months after, in October 2010, the UN brought in some soldiers who had cholera, the most virulent form of cholera from Nepal, did not screen them medically, and they ended up dumping their raw feces into one of the largest rivers in Haiti, and right now, 2 years later, 8,000 Haitians have died. Now, this is on top of over 300,000 Haitians dead in 33 seconds in the largest, most worst disaster in terms of death in less than half a minute. So right now we have 8,000 Haitians dead from UN-imported cholera and over 620,000 Haitians who have gone to the hospital with infections of cholera. So Canada was very, very pivotal. One of the ways of branding tyranny right now is to use the reputation of a country that may have had like a progressive reputation of being, you know, out of wars, not warmonger. Well, they use that with Canada. Canada hosted something called the Ottawa Initiative right before the 2004 kidnapping of President Aristide. Your folks should know I was a lawyer for President Aristide at some point when he first came back in 1995, I think, 1994, the first time he went back, the first coup d'etat when he went back. Canada hosted this thing called the Ottawa Initiative, where they got together with the foreign ministers of all the countries in the West and decided that Haiti had to be occupied, and that they could not allow President Aristide in democratic rule of Haiti, because then that would hurt the corporate profit over people mentality of the unfettered capitalists who knew of Haiti's resources and felt that black people's resources should not be left in the hands of black people. It should be left in the hands, of course, of the you know, the global elite for them to steal. And so Canada is very, very pivotal in what's going on in Haiti, and it has been from the beginning. It hosted the Ottawa Initiative. I can't, you know, go through all the details. And then in that Ottawa Initiative, basically what it said was that by 2020, Haiti would have something like over 20 million people. Right now, Haiti has 10 million people, and they said that would be dangerous to, I guess, you know, white supremacist domination. I'm not sure. Folks can go read the documentation. It's on our website at esleydantal.com. And then France, the interest in this, you know, triumvirate, this amazing aggression against a country without even an army is, you know, folks say and point to the fact that President Aristide had asked for the independence debt back from France. As your audience knows, France was the colonizers of Haiti before my ancestors beat them in combat and became the first nation of enslaved people in the world to beat their aggressors and not choose the aggressor's language, the aggressor's religion, the aggressor's philosophy of life. We don't do bourgeois philosophy, bourgeois democracy in Haiti. I mean, the people have been struggling for over 200 years now to try to bring into application what they wanted to do for the Haitian Revolution, which is for the country to be equitably shared by all of its citizens, not just this 1% owning 98% of the wealth as it is with the Europeans. So the independence debt that President Aristide asked for was at that time in 2004, $22 billion, which France had forced Haiti to pay back. What that means is that we were enslaved for almost 300 years by the Europeans, first the Spanish for 100 and then the French for 300. But when Haiti won its independence in 1804, France could not allow or kept coming back with cannons. And once the white tribes had a rapprochement upon themselves because they were fighting against each other, Jefferson got the Louisiana Purchase as a result of the war where the African warriors kicked the French out of Haiti, and therefore, you know, Napoleon didn't have a platform. But the point is that the Louisiana Territory in America, which was, you know, French territory in what is now the United States, was about made about 15 states altogether for the U.S. But that was sold to Jefferson, President Jefferson, after Haiti won its independence in 1804 by Napoleon for $15 million. Now listen. France.
That's not funny at all.
France paid forced Haiti to pay. Now, for the Louisiana Territory, which was half the size of the U.S., and Haiti is about maybe the size of the smallest, like Rhode Island. Haiti was forced to pay 106. That's 10 times the amount that Jefferson paid for the Louisiana Territory. Haiti was paid to pay $150 million. Now, this is after we won in combat. All of the European white tribes got together and said, you know, the only reason you can stand as an independent nation is if you pay France back for it losing my grand as property. So from 1820 to like 1947, that is the independence debt. And President Aristide, when he came into office and he was embargoed and ostracized by the Europeans, he said, you know, we want this independence debt back, and that is one of the reasons why France, you know, also was, you know, so offended. And they've always thought that Haiti was their property anyways, because they came back in 1806 after the death of Dessalines and came back through ecclesiastic colonialism and by doing our education, by making French the national language when everyone speaks Creole, but the educated folks that always feel they were more Eurocentric than African. So we have a situation where France, Canada, and the United States came together in 2004 to do this coup d'etat. But what's really significant about it, and the reason that we stand at the Haitian Lawyers Leadership against all of this, And my name is Danton is because 2004 was the 200th, would have marked the 200th anniversary of Haiti's bicentennial, and they wanted to make a point that you cannot be free with a freely elected president without our without us being involved. And so they all came, you know, the rabid elites came, and it has been one tyranny after the other, whether it's before the earthquake or after the earthquake with the UN cholera, or whether it's with the taking, you know, $7.5 billion in misery from Haitians in order to, you know, live their lives and defray from the economic world depression going on. Anybody who wants, any white folk or black northerner collaborator who wants, you know, a job right now can just go and make out a grant and say they're going to help some orphanage or whatever in Haiti, and they have their living expenses paid while the Haitian people continue to suffer, because the scam is that they're humanitarians. But a reality is, it's the warmongering North taking out Haiti's resources, devastating the environment, and thinning out the population.
Ezili, could I, we have 15 minutes left, 14 minutes left, and I wanted you to complete that thought, but then I wanted you to talk about women and the Haitian Revolution, and also I wanted to tell you some stuff about Al Prentice Bunchy Carter and his relationship to Dessalines, but I hope I didn't cut you off.
No. How many minutes do you say we have?
Yeah, about 14 minutes now.
14 minutes, okay. And you want to talk about the women of the Haitian Revolution?
Yeah, because I heard you in Toronto, and many of us read C.L.R. James' book, Black Jacobins, which he wrote in 1938, and that was a breakthrough book in terms of the Haitian Revolution. But one of the things that we realized was that when we read that book, we only heard about Toussaint Louverture, Dessalines, and Christophe, and, for whatever reason, CLR didn't talk about any the role that the women played that much. But when I heard you in Toronto, you talked about Dessalines' mother and the role that women had played in the Haitian Revolution, and I would like for you to share that with the listening audience.
Absolutely. Paternalism, racism, all of that deals with why women are erased in civil rights history in America or in the Haitian Revolution. So I have a piece, since we don't have much time, I would urge folks to go to our website, ezilidanto.com. We are a people of struggle from the womb to the tomb. And because we struggle is the reason why my voice can be heard today. Because this voice was paid for in realms and reams of blood. And black women in Haiti took up guns, rifles, and fought for the liberty and the respect of the children that would fall, you know, down their thighs. And Haiti is significant in so many, many ways. It is sort of the symbolic representation of the defiled black woman since the Europeans came out of their cave and found out there were other people in the world who were different than them, and they used their violence and their religion to destroy and commit genocide and build societies on genocide. Well, you know, in 1791, when the Haitian Revolution began, and the reason my name is Ezili Danton, it is the name of the Haitian divine archetype, the African divine archetype, that is the symbolic representation of generosity, love, beauty to the Africans who became Haitians in the land of the Taino. And this name that they gave to this energy. And this is not a human being. We don't domesticate God or the divine by giving it a face. It is a energy of, like I said, generosity, nurturing. If you look at Isis with the child, or if you look at the icon that's used by the Christian church with the mother that's nursing the child, that is the physical representation of what has become, what is Esli Dantal, is that that's the physical representation of it by the Christians, by the Egyptians, and so forth. But for the Haitian, it is something that they draw with their bodies. It's a heart with a dagger going through it. So that's the mother. That's the mother who's been betrayed. That's the mother who herself cuts out evil with good, which is the representation. It's called a veva in Haitian spirituality, and it is the representation of love. It's the representation of generosity, beauty, fertility, and womanhood. And that's Esli Dantal. And on August 14, 1791, that was the predominant energy that motivated the warriors on a hilltop to begin the Haitian Revolution. This energy of protection, of mothering, is the energy that came out, and the historical figure of that who spoke for this energy, her name is Cécile Fatima. She was a Vodou priestess. And so that's one in terms of Haitian, how the Haitian Revolution began. You will probably read in C.L.R. James that it began with this woman standing with warriors and maroons, I mean, folks who had fought for their liberty for years and years and years, and she was the presiding warrior.
Fatima was her name?
Cécile Fatima.
Many Haitians came from, I guess, Benin, or what was called Dahomey, is that correct?
Well, many Haitians came from all of West Africa, Benin, and all the way down to Angola and the Congo. So we came not only from the West Africa and Dahomey, but also the Congo. And Vodun is the legend is 21 nations stood. And 21 nations they were talking about, not just nations in terms of geographical territory of places in Africa, but you're talking about a spiritual nation. And then that spiritual nation covered many, many geographical places in Haiti, in Africa. It's like I said, the Angola, all the way down to Angola. Yeah, Congo and Angola. So Cécile Fatima, Bookman, Cécile Fatima, people have said that their names are a Muslim. So you know that there was a war in Africa way before the Europeans came with the Arabs, a force assimilating. So whether the African had been converted as a Muslim or converted as a Christian or whatever, at Bwakaima on August 14, 1791, they all went back to the mother religion of Africa, Vodun. They all stood up. They all stood up and bowed to Esli Dantal, which came through the historical figure of Cécile Fatima. And just like you see Isis with the back in the day, you know, when women were divinely elevated as mothers and warriors before patriarchy took hold centuries ago, it was the woman that would decide who of her sons would become the king, the prince.
Mm-hmm.
So in the same manner, at Bwakaima, Esli Dantal chose who would lead the Haitian Revolution amongst the 200 warriors who were present at that very secret meeting. And she picked a man called Bookman, And that's how the Haitian Revolution began. And Eslie Danton is known as the mother of the revolution, as the inspirer, and so forth. So that's the first, these two women. And then you have folks like, I'm just going to say their names so people can just look at it, because I don't know how much time we have, but we have women who had their own, what do you call that? When you have like a group of warriors who follow you, you know, like
platoon or squadron,
yeah,
or platoon. Right.
Exactly. So Défilé, we have Marie-Jeanne, we have Sanit Belair. These are women who, I have a piece called Dessalines, which is Haiti's founding father, because as you were mentioning, folks always lift up Toussaint Louverture, because Toussaint Louverture's paradigm did not reach all the way to taking out all of slavery. He was going to put the people back into the plantations in order to pay back the in order to keep Haiti financially going. But Dessalines, who is Haiti's founding father, who is the guy who said, okay, so Toussaint stood for what Toussaint wanted was to be the black ruler of a French colony in Haiti, and so he that's what he stood for, and that is what is the paradigm. He was killed. For that, by the French. But then when Dessalines rose after his death, they really saw that the handwriting was on the wall, and they had to delay black rule, independent nation. And to this day, Dessalines' ideology, which is that Haiti would be a black rule, independent nation, is what Haitians struggle towards. Right now, you have Obama, for instance, you have at the U.S., you have Kagame over in, let's say,
Rwanda.
You have Museveni in oh gosh,
Uganda.
Uganda, and then you have Kabila in Congo. These guys, the way we look at it as Vodouists in Haiti, they are black collaborators whose only demand is that they share in the leadership and in the command of the white supremacist system. They're not about changing it. They just want leadership and command and to be part of it. Jean-Jacques Dessalines did not want to be, you know, like Toussaint Louverture, get leadership and command and become, you know, a satellite of France. He wanted a black rule, independent nation where the people could decide, Creole is my language, Vodun is my spirituality, and this is my culture, and I am African, and I want to live in peaceful coexistence with you, but you will not dominate me. That is what Haitians right now, the reason why you have Obama sending 20,000 troops when Haitians were crushed under steel and rubble and the whole place had fallen down, is because they did not want the folks to take down their occupation and stop their resource wars. He didn't send those 20,000 troops to help lift up concrete and save lives. Now that's why you have this army of NGOs to fool the good American people and the good folks in France and the good folks in, you know,
Canada.
This is about humanitarian aid in Canada, yeah. So essentially, what we're living is this these black collaborators, you know, like I said, they all, what they want out of, you know, modern society is that they get command and leadership and be part of this profit over people vampire system. And so they're all over, and this Toussaint Louverture, and I'm sure Toussaint Louverture probably didn't even see all the significance. He just thought that that's the most he could do because he was educated into this European system and figured, you know, the most I can do is become a ruler of Haiti, and Haiti will be a colony. But Dessalines came and said, no, we will be a black rule independent nation. We will take the names and honor the Taínos and take the and name this nation IET, the name that came before, the land of my homeland. And the women like Marie-Jeanne, the women like Sanit Belair, for instance, just to give you, I'll give you two, Sanit Belair and Défilé. Défilé, like I said, she was a sort of like, she gave she gave resources and supplies to the troops. She followed the troops, but she also had her own troops. You have Glenn Guillotin, who was a spiritual advisor to Jean-Jacques Dessalines. He didn't go to war without going to Glenn Guillotin. Glenn Guillotin means was a Haitian Vaudouist priest. She told him, for instance, the day that he died, not to go south to Pétion, to see Pétion, that this would be the day of his death. But he did not listen to her, and he died. There's a great story of Glenn Guillotin. Those of you who, I think I have photos of her monument in Haiti. If you go to my personal page on Facebook, go to my public page of Esli Danton, you'll see we just recently sponsored four Haitian market women to go to India to learn how to be solar engineers, and in that process we brought them to see Haitian culture, and we brought them to the monument of Glenn Guillotin. Now that's a story I can't tell because I don't have the time, but défilé, for instance,
I wanted to say that I'm very sorry, but we're going to have to bring you back, but I wanted to say one thing and then let you give out your information, but I wanted to let you know that Alfred Spongy Carter was very fond of Dessalines. Also, he was fond of...
Who did you say? What's the name?
Alfred Spongy Carter from the Black Panther Party in Los Angeles, and also his partner who died with him on January 17th, John Huggins, had a Kittitian background. His parents, his father, I think, was from St. Kitts. And there's a young man by the name of Linford. He's writing a book about Bunchy. But could you give out your information? Because we've basically run over time, but I wanted to let people know how they can get a hold of you.
Okay, yes. Thank you for having me. Thank you for listening. Our website is ezilidanto.com, and all of our recent information is at the same place, but just put /Zili, Z-I-L-I, so ezilidanto.com /Zili. You will get all of the newest writings. You can join the Esli Danton Network and help us tell the truth about Haiti. We have videos. We have lots of interviews like this one that you can listen to. And so forth. And we have a project of clean water and solar energy that we're trying to get financed. So those who are interested in a black rule independent nation and changing the paradigm where the profit over people in this world rule while the majority are just lingering in this sort of amazing economic slavery, come and let's talk and let's engage in how we can make a change.
All right, thank you very much, and we're going to continue with we're going to do our tribute to the Vibrations, a group out of Los Angeles, California, and thank you once again, Ezili.
Much obliged.
You're listening to WhoRadio.com, voice of the International African Revolution.
Jalali speaking to you from Los Angeles, California, and we have been listening to the music of The Vibrations, a group out of Los Angeles, California. They did two selections, the Watusi and My Girl Sloopy, and what the Vibrations were led by a man by the name of Carl Fisher, who is still in the land of the living, and I went to YouTube last night, and they're still performing, and they started out in Los Angeles, California. And they were there. I've never been able to find any footage of the Vibrations other than this new footage, but they were one of the best groups in terms of dancing and comedy. And the Temptation Walk came from the Sloop Dance. And we're going to play a song now called Peanut Butter, and then we're going to play a song called Hully Gully. And Peanut Butter is a song that was put together by a young man who used to live next door to me, H.P. Barnum, and it was supposed was a takeoff from the Hully Gully. We're going to be playing the Olympics after we play Peanut Butter by the Vibrations. I think they use the name the Marathons, but this is Vibrations, and I think this, well, I know this is Carl Fisher on lead, but this is the Marathons or the Vibrations singing Peanut Butter.
Peanut butter.
Listening to Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. This is the Uhuru Radio Network. We're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn after we finish this tribute to the Vibrations. The Vibrations were a vocal group coming out of Los Angeles, California. They were active, and they started in the mid-50s, and I guess they officially broke up in 1976. But Carl Fisher, who is, I guess, the founder and the leader of the group, is still out there on the road performing with a new set of Vibrations. But the Vibrations are Don Bradley, Carl Fisher, Don Govin, James Johnson, and Ricky Owens. Ricky Owens is replaced Eddie Kendricks in the Temptations. And if you read Otis Williams' book, the temptations you can. He talks about how the temptations temptations walk was based on the sloop dance by the Vibrations, and when Eddie Kendricks was going to leave the group, the first person that they looked towards was Ricky Owens, and we're going to be playing three songs by Ricky Owens right now. Misty, and I Remember the Rain. This is the Vibrations featuring the voice of the late, great Ricky Owens.
Oh, a minute. this wonderland alone, never knowing my right foot from my left, my hat from my glove. I get misty and too much in love. Misty, I'm misty.
Diasporic Music on Uhuru Radio. My name is Jalali, a.k.a. Norman Otis Richmond, speaking to you from Southern California. We were listening to Ricky Owens and the Vibrations, and the song Ricky Owens sang was I Remember the Rain, and that was a Gamble and Huff production. They were with Gamble and Huff for a few moments. Misty was made famous, I guess, by Earl Garner wrote it, and Johnny Mathis made it really famous, but a lot of people like Ricky Owens' rendition of Misty, and Oh Cindy, and like I say, Ricky Owens was with the Temptations for a brief moment, but he had some difficulties, and he was replaced by Damon Harris. But right now we wanted to play the last song by the Vibrations, Ain't No Greens in Harlem, and then we're going to be speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn.
need was some good old-fashioned green. Didn't want no yam, didn't want no ham, didn't want no butter beans. I shot down to the market, and there I saw a sign. I must be going crazy, or else I'm going blind, because the sign said, I didn't read that. I think something wrong with the Lord. Something's wrong. What? Y'all know where it went? I caught myself a subway. I got off way across town. I'm gonna get myself some green today or tear the damn door down. I finally found the window and eased myself inside. But the rats got there before I did, so I left unsatisfied.
Ain't no reason holler.
What you say?
That's my man on strike.
Can you believe this?
Ain't no reason holler.
Oh my goodness.
That's my man on strike.
I don't know what I'm doing now.
Ain't no reason holler.
Anybody know where he went?
That's my man on strike. He's been gone so long. Ain't coming back.
You mean never?
Network, and my name is Norman Otis Richmond, a.k.a. Jalali, speaking to you from Southern California, and we were listening to the last song by the Vibrations called Ain't No Greens in Harlem, and joining me on the line is Dr. Gerald Horn, author of Fighting in Paradise, Labor Unions, Racism and Communists in the Making of Modern Hawaii, and another great volume called Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans and the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation. And today we're going to have a very lively discussion about a number of issues. How are you doing, Dr. Horn?
Fine, and yourself?
Well, I'm good. I guess we wanted to talk about Algeria, Mali, Pakistan, but first I wanted to ask you, there was an article in the Los Angeles Times about a month ago. The article was Hawkish Leaders Take Over North Asia. They were talking about China, Japan, and North and South Korea. And I wanted you to basically talk about what that means to Africa and the Caribbean. But I guess you have to explain who these four leaders are.
Well, basically, what we see in Northeast Asia is what might be called a kind of dynastic politics. For example, ruling in North Korea, the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea, is the grandson of the founder of that state, Kim Il-sung. Recall that the Democratic People's Republic of North Korea emerges after World War II concludes in 1945 with the defeat of the Japanese occupation of the Korean Peninsula, which had begun in 1910, in the emergence of the DPRK under the leadership of the Workers' Party, otherwise known as the Communist Party. Then in its neighbor, South Korea, you have the election of the daughter of the former dictator, Park Chung-hee, who was killed, you might recall, just a few decades ago. Now, the first conflict is that between North and South Korea, because, of course, North Korea feels there should be reunification. And in fact, there's been some movement in the South on that level, too. What does this mean for people of African descent? Well, you may recall that between 1950 and 1953, a number of people of African descent died fighting on the Korean Peninsula. A number of people of African descent wound up being jailed by the U.S. authorities because they refused to fight on the Korean Peninsula. Some of the black American soldiers who went to the Korean Peninsula wound up defecting to the side of North Korea and also to the side of their ally, which was the People's Republic of China, which had come into existence in late 1949. Now, in Japan, you have the recent election of Shinzo Abe, who is the grandson of a former Japanese prime minister who, in fact, was jailed by the U.S. authorities after the United States defeated Japan in World War II, a defeat that culminated with the first and so far only use of nuclear weapons, with nuclear weapons dropped, as you recall, in August 1945 on Hiroshima and Nagasaki. And there are longstanding conflicts between Japan and both Koreas, interestingly enough. Even though Japan and South Korea are, shall we say, allies of the United States, Japan and South Korea have a longstanding antagonism based upon what South Korea sees as Japan's brutal occupation of the Korean Peninsula beginning in 1910. Now, for those of us who are of African descent who speak about being oppressed and enslaved by Europeans going back hundreds of years, I guess some are scratching their heads. Like, 1910? So, okay, fine. 35 years? What's the big deal? But that's not how the Koreans see it, for better or for worse. Then, in China, you just had a leadership change with Xi Jinping taking over as a head of the Communist Party, probably the largest political organization on this small planet, and also to be president of China as well. The problem there is that there is this territorial dispute between China and Japan over these uninhabited islands, which the Japanese call the Senkaku, and Chinese have another name for it. But if that were the only problem, perhaps we could go back to sleep and not pay attention to this question. But it's much more complicated. In fact, just within the last 24 to 48 hours, both Japan and China sent fighter jets into the air over these islands, which is very worrisome. There has been real talk about a war, believe it or not, between the second largest economy, China, and the third largest economy, Japan, a war which, of course, U.S. imperialism would benefit from. And it's very worrisome, and it's made even more difficult and intractable by the fact that China also has bad relations with a number of its neighbors. Recall that in October 1962, when the world was fixated on the so-called Cuban Missile Crisis and the effort by Moscow and Havana to guard against another U.S. invasion of Cuba, with Moscow placing missiles in China and the United States threatening nuclear war unless those missiles were removed. Well, recall that it was during that precise moment when the world was distracted that China chose to invade India, which brought then Prime Minister Nehru to tears. Recall that in 1979, China invaded Vietnam. I mean, in fact, as I've argued and written, the beginning of the takeoff of the Chinese economy comes when then paramount leader Deng Xiaoping comes to the United States in February of 1979 and basically cuts a deal, in my opinion, to not only attack Vietnam, but the payoff would be inward direct foreign investment from U.S. corporations, which leads to the economic takeoff of the Chinese economy. I might also add that in December 1979, after the Moscow intervention in Afghanistan to prop up an allied government there, China joined with U.S. imperialism, with regard to helping to destabilize Afghanistan and helping to bring into force these conservative religious radicals who are now waging war, as we well know, and we'll talk about shortly, even though that, in my opinion, was a real detriment to China, which has a sizable Muslim minority itself. So China really has complicated its existence by its previous actions. And now you see that Shinzo Abe, after he was elected, one of his first stops was Vietnam. And because China also has an ongoing territorial dispute with Vietnam. It has an ongoing territorial dispute with the Philippines, another U.S. ally, which formerly housed U.S. bases. So it's a very complicated scenario that is made all the worse by the fact that the U.S. administration has talked about this pivot to Asia. And the U.S. is moving a number of its military assets into the Asia-Pacific region. I argued in the book on Hawaii that you mentioned that one of the reasons for these islands, this archipelago 2,000 miles on the North American mainland, is somehow a state of the United States, presumably the fifth and final state coming into the United States in 1959, speaking of Hawaii, it's because it's an unsinkable aircraft carrier in the Pacific. And U.S. ruling elites recognized early on that the future is Asia. That's where the population is. That's where a lot of the resources are. And so the 21st century is poised for a conflict between Washington and Beijing, but that conflict may be preempted, if you like, by this ongoing tension between Japan and China.
Let me say that, could you briefly talk about Japan? The current head of state of Japan is talking about backing off of the semi-passive thing where they're not going to participate in any wars. He's basically saying they're going to retool and they're ready to put their army back together. Is that the case?
Well, yes. The current head of government, I should say, Prime Minister Shinzo Abe, has talked about that. And it's ongoing. I mean, despite this pacifist language in the Japanese Constitution, which was foisted upon Tokyo by the then leader of the occupation forces, General Douglas MacArthur, who you may recall was sacked by President Truman after he thought that President Truman was too much of a dove with regard to the war in the Korean Peninsula. General MacArthur thought nuclear weapons should have been used against China and North Korea, believe it or not. And so, yes, China is moving aggressively away from its pacifist constitution. And this is very worrisome. This is very troublesome.
Let me say that in terms of China, could you talk about the relationship that African Americans or African people in America, was Du Bois the first one to go to China? We had the Shirley Graham Du Bois, William Edward Burghardt Du Bois, Robert Williams. Could you talk about briefly the relationship between Africans in the United States and China?
I will. But first, let me talk about Africans in the United States and Japan, a relationship that takes off Japan defeats Russia in 1905. As I've written in a previous book entitled Race War, W.B. Du Bois, Booker T. Washington, Marcus Garvey, they had many conflicts between and amongst themselves, but all agreed upon the importance of Japan. If you look at the early black nationalist movement, as I do in that book and as other scholars have done, and I can cite chapter and verse if you're interested, you basically had these black nationalists who were pro-Tokyo. I mean, look at the origins of the Nation of Islam, for example, and look at the fact that so many of the black nationalists in and out of the Nation of Islam refused to fight in World War II because of their sympathies towards Tokyo. Now, all of that, in a sense, went up in smoke, if you like, in 1945 after Japan was defeated. And you saw the Nation of Islam, for example, pivot, to use the verb of the day, towards Africa under the leadership of Malcolm X. And you would think that that's always been the case, but no, that it's not the case. As all you have to do is a linguistic or an etymological excavation and look at the term Asiatic black man. Where do you think that term came from? In any case,
right,
the relationship between China and Japan, of course, mostly stems from revolutionary China, post-1949 China. Before 1949, many peoples of African descent, not only the nationalists, but I would also point out to certain NAACP leaders, like William Pickens, for example, who's now forgotten, they all saw China as the Uncle Toms of Asia, because recall that during this time, Japan was trying to subjugate China, particularly in the 1930s, and many of the U.S. Negro leadership thought that China should succumb. But China didn't succumb. And in fact, part of the narrative of the Chinese Communist Party that helps to prop up their legitimacy is that they're the ones who led the struggle against the Japanese occupation beginning in the 1930s and culminating with Japan's defeat in 1945. And it was the so-called nationalists under the man we refer to as Chiang Kai-shek who was defeated by the Chinese Communists, and then, of course, evacuated to the island of Taiwan, where his ideological descendants still reside, although not necessarily rule. It was the nationalists who tended to be pro-Tokyo, like nationalists in Black America, nationalists in Turkey, and nationalists in many other places. I'm reading a book now about Ethiopia in the 1930s. It's very interesting, I should add, talking about how the Ethiopian nationalists also were pro-Tokyo in the 1930s. Now, after the advent of Chinese communist rule, of course, as I talk about in my biography of Shirley Graham Du Bois, you had people, individuals like her, the otherwise known as the widow of W.E.B. Du Bois, who, of course, resided intermittently in China, you know, Robert F. Williams. Of course, the Black Panther Party. I just read this interesting book by Joshua Bloom and Waldo E. Martin, Black Against Empire, The History and Politics of the Black Panther Party, just came out from University of California Press. And the book begins with Huey P. Newton and his Panther delegation in Hong Kong on their way to China to break bread with Zhou Enlai, the number two leader,
right,
the prime minister of China. So, yes, this relationship was quite strong. Now, of course, I have my own critique of that relationship, but I won't go there at this particular moment.
Last thing was that Panthers had a relationship with so-called North Korea. I remember I used to do some work at the Toronto Star, and you know, people would always talk about how the North Koreans were coming in with this big bucket of money to take a full-page ad out in the Toronto Star. But Eldridge Cleaver and a number of other people from the Panthers had a relationship with North Korea. Could you talk about that? Then we'll go to Molly.
Oh, sure. I mean, not only that, but when I was leading the National Conference of Black Lawyers and living in New York in the 1970s and 1980s, on a regular basis, we would break bread with the United Nations delegation from the Democratic People's Republic of Korea. And, of course, delegations were sent there and all the rest. Of course, there's a long history about that, even though, of course, the DPRK does not have diplomatic relations with the United States of America. And in fact, relations right now may be at a new low, perhaps not as low as 1952-53, but certainly at a new low because of these allegations that the DPRK is trying to develop missiles that will the territory of the United States, Alaska and California, for example, and how supposedly that presents a threat to U.S. national security.
I'm speaking with Dr. Gerald Horn, author of a great book called Negro Comrades of the Crown, African Americans in the British Empire Fight the U.S. Before Emancipation, but we wanted to move to Africa, to Mali. And there is there was an article a couple of days ago in the Los Angeles Times talking about there's a split between the Pentagon and the White House over how the United States should relate to what's taking place in Mali. First of all, what is your assessment of what is taking place in Mali?
Well, I find it ironic, and I take no pleasure in the fact that perhaps the most significant legacy that the first black president will leave for Africa is a war in northern and northwest Africa that will be destabilizing for years and decades to come. I take no pleasure in that, and I should also say that historians of the future will find it quite curious and will be scratching their heads over the fact that some of them will even be called Obama bashers. Some of the most stringent critics of the current U.S. administration were either quiet when this conflict began to unfold in 2011 in Libya, or in fact supported the NATO bombing campaign in Libya. After I finish this little peroration, I'd like to ask you to explain to me how it was that Obama bashers could be in support of what was probably, what is probably the most significant blunder of this administration. But, as noted, this conflict can fairly be said to have begun with the bombing campaign following the UN resolution of March 2011, which supposedly was to protect civilians but led to regime change. This U.S.-led bombing campaign was a reversal of the previous relationship between the Gaddafi regime in Italy and the U.S. administration. They had cooperated in terms of containing conservative religious radicals, oftentimes referred to as Islamists. But the United States decided to turn the tables on Gaddafi, and of course they did. He was killed, and now the predictable happened. In order to effectuate the overthrow of Gaddafi, tons of weapons were dropped in northern Africa. Many of those weapons leaked into neighboring Mali. This led to an escalation of an ongoing conflict between north and south, which led in 2012 to the civilian government being overthrown by U.S.-trained military leaders, I should add. Similarly, U.S.-trained regiments defected to the Islamist side in 2012, giving momentum to the so-called Islamists, who in the past 7 to 10 days, we were told, were beginning to march south towards Bamako and perhaps taking over the entire country, which led to a French intervention in Mali, supposedly to be backed up soon by troops from Nigeria and Senegal and all of its neighbors. The jets that are bombing northern Mali are taking off from neighboring Chad, which also suggests that Chad will be dragged into this conflict. France is very concerned about its uranium interests in neighboring Niger. The uranium, of course, is necessary for the French electricity industry, which is heavily dependent upon nuclear power. Algeria has been dragged into this. As you know, Algeria objected to the NATO war in Libya. Algeria houses current members of the Gaddafi family who fled from Libya. I should add parenthetically that Algeria some years ago housed a mission of the Black Panther Party, an organization which of course came up in our previous segment. We all know about the hostage crisis just bloodily ended when so-called Islamists supposedly took over a natural gas facility in Algeria, although we have to look at that with a very keen eye, because the North Atlantic nations have been very suspicious of Algeria, because in marketing and distributing its natural gas, it's tried to broker an alliance with Putin's Russia, which also sends natural gas to Europe. Algeria also sends oil to the United States. And the North Atlantic nations were not very happy about their relationships with Putin's Russia. You know, Putin's Russia is not the so-called fair-haired boy of the North Atlantic nation. I should also add in this context that the way things are going, within years, Russia's economy will be larger than the economy of Germany, which should not be surprising since there are 82 million people in Germany and about 150, 160 million in Russia. So sooner than rather than later, that would have to become the reality. In any case, the economic community of West African states were meeting in Abidjan this past Saturday, just yesterday. You may recall that the leader of Cote d'Ivoire, who presided over this meeting, was put into power by French paratroopers. Just last week, French interests landed in Somalia and killed some members of al-Shabaab, the so-called Islamists, there in order to, they say, effectuate the liberation of a kidnapped victim. Now, when historians once again look back at this period, I think one of the things they'll find interesting is that despite France's vampirish behavior in Africa, and there's nothing new about this, this has been going on for years, black Americans have really little to say about France and Africa. They had a lot to say negatively about Soviet Union in Africa, even though the Soviets were funding liberation forces fighting against white supremacy. They had a lot to say negative about that. They had little to say about France, even though France was a vampire. Historians are going to be scratching their head about that. But once again, I throw it over to you to tell me how and why it was that Obama bashers could support or be quiet about what was his most significant blunder.
Well, first of all, I wanted to say that I think there is there have been some people, Africans in the United States, have been very vocal about French imperialism. I would like to talk about the Uhuru movement and the African People's Socialist Party on their website has been really causing a lot of talking a whole lot, should we say, talking about the role France has played in imperialism. The imperialist role that France is playing in Africa right now, in terms of Gaddafi, was portrayed as a madman, and some people perceive Gaddafi as perceived as a madman by the West, but a lot of people related to Muammar Gaddafi because Muammar Gaddafi did a lot to aid Africa in terms of. There were many delegations who went from all around the world, who from the black world, beginning with, I think Rosie Douglas used to bring people from Canada, the United States, and the Caribbean to Gaddafi. And I think that, Gaddafi, the left viewed Gaddafi as a problem because he didn't necessarily go along with their line of the third way, which whatever you might think about it, I think he was dealing with helping the African continent. That's how I see it.
So therefore, these people on the left who don't like Obama and critique him every step of the way, they went along with his bombing of Libya because they didn't like the third way.
Yes, it's part of it's the whole white supremacy thing. You know, some of the people on the left, especially a lot of the social democrats, basically believe in white supremacy anywhere. I think it was Lenin who criticized the social democrats for jumping into World War One instead of supporting the workers of the world. They supported their bourgeoisie, and I think this is a similar thing which took place in Libya. If that's how I see it. I don't know how you see it.
Well, I think that many of these forces we're talking about, that oftentimes they don't really do political analysis. I mean, even if
determination, and we on Reparations in Action and from the African People's Solidarity Committee and Uhuru Solidarity Movement, thank everybody for listening today, and we really want to encourage people to get involved in Uhuru Solidarity Movement. Become a member. Go to uhurusolidarity.org. That's our website. You can join. Just click Join USM to become a member. $25 a year or $10 a year if you're a student, or you can become a monthly sustainer. Of many different levels to contribute monthly to the work of the Uhuru movement. And also, we want to call for everyone's solidarity in going to the International People's Democratic Uhuru Movement Convention, March 23rd and 24th in St. Petersburg, Florida, the city of African resistance. We're going to be attending that and going in solidarity with all of the